We're delighted to welcome several groups here this morning. We have students from Lancaster High School. Would they please stand? Good to see you all. You may be seated. We have students from Catholic Central High School. Would you stand, please? It's good to see you. You may be seated. And we have Eagle 6th and 7th grades. Would you all stand? It's good having you with us, too. You may be seated. Students are here with the Court with Class programs. They're invited to come hear an oral argument, and if they accept the invitation, they're given the briefs of the case, and then they have the opportunity to meet after this second case with a justice of the court. Now, have the Eagle 6th and 7th grade students received synopses of the case they're about to hear? Do you have a description of what the case is? Yes, sir.
We have one of the lawyers in the book.
Okay, thank you. And if anyone has not received materials about the case and would like to read a short description of the case, which I think will help you listen to the presentations, the short descriptions are outside the courtroom in the entranceway. Does anyone need such a description? Okay. The Court with Class program is a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. And part of it is not only I introduce you all to the court, but I introduce the court to you all. And starting on my far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. And seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice with whom you're going to meet today. Seated to my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her left, Justice David Prosser. And on the far left, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, we'll call our second case for today and our last case on the December calendar, 03-2027, Clover E. Lagerstrom versus Myrtleworth Hospital. Arguing for Mr. Lagerstrom is Charles B. Harris. Mr. Harris.
May it please the court, counsel for the defendant. I do represent Clover Lagerstrom, who is the surviving widow of and personal representative of the estate of Vance Lagerstrom. The primary issue in this appeal is whether or not Wisconsin statute section 893.55(7) is constitutional. It's our position that it violates the Constitution in several respects. That section provides in relevant part that evidence of any compensation from sources other than the defendant is admissible. This section does not limit the substantive rights of persons who have claims based upon subrogation. In other words, any payments made by potentially even friends who contribute gifts to help people pay medical bills or bills paid by medical insurance or possible other sources, evidence of that is ordered by this statute to be received. The legislative history in regards to that bill provides that it modifies the, quote, collateral source rule by merely allowing evidence regarding other sources of compensation to be presented to a jury in a medical malpractice action. It does not require an offset or a reduction of any malpractice award by the amount of any other payments. We believe that the statute fails the constitutional test on the initial basis of violating the separation of powers doctrine of the Constitution. We think the statute violates that doctrine in a couple of respects. First of all, it compels the trial court to receive into evidence evidence that has always been deemed irrelevant to the question that the jury is to determine, which is, what is the fair and reasonable value of the medical services a plaintiff has incurred as a result of the injuries done to them by the wrongdoer?
Well, what's wrong with the jury hearing what the actual expenses were and who paid for them?
Because it has nothing to do with the factual issue the jury is required to determine, which is, under the rule as established by this court, the fair and reasonable value of the services incurred.
Well, counsel, maybe I need to hear from you. What is, I guess I'm having trouble following how it's a violation of separation of powers, how it interferes with the court's function to give the jury more evidence as opposed to less.
Well, I think it interferes with the court's function in this. It's impossible for me to conceive of a function more important to a trial court in Wisconsin than to determine what evidence should properly be considered by a jury and is relevant to the factual issue a jury has to consider. And so when the legislature tells a court that you've got to admit evidence that is not relevant to one of those issues that a jury has to decide.
Mr. Harris, isn't this a situation of shared powers?
No, it is not.
Why not?
Because it is essentially a core judicial function.
Why is it a core judicial function? I'm having trouble understanding that.
I think it's a core judicial function in two respects, and if I can maybe finish off my second thought, I'll come back to the issue, Your Honor. The second fashion in which it invades a core judicial function is this. It does not mandate an offset, but allows it. And so this statute would attempt to determine what this court has in numerous cases determined to be a question of law, attempts to assign that duty to a jury. And under the supposition, I guess, that by somehow assigning it to a jury, what becomes what has always been a question of law when facts are undisputed, now is a decision that a jury should make. And it assigns to the jury, as I think the Court of Appeals recognized in its order, the right to make a legal determination as to what is the measurement of damages that a party who is injured in a, by the negligence of another party is entitled to recover.
Well, let me give you my simple-minded approach, okay? When I look at what's happened with the rules of evidence through the years, when I look at matters of pleading practice and procedure, I find that sometimes the legislature has acted, sometimes the court has acted in adopting Supreme Court rules, but it's always been a shared power kind of situation. And I just don't see where this is getting to the core of judicial power. Where do we draw this line with saying it's the core that's being touched here, not the normal shared power situation?
I think the core is touched here, Your Honor, because the court in this situation by this statute is not allowed to define to the jury what the law is.
Well, why wouldn't the court? Maybe that's the connection that I'm missing. As I understood the legislation here, the legislation dealt with the issue of admissibility, and I think Justice Crooks is correct. Legislatures do that all the time. The rape shield law is an example. If the concern is what the law is, can't the court deal with that through the instructions given to the jury?
Then what is the court to do? A court who's charged with the duty of keeping irrelevant evidence out?
And the legislature's deemed this to be relevant.
Well, they didn't say that. They said it's admissible. And so if the court admits the testimony and the fundamental law has not been changed, which is the plaintiff is entitled to recover for the reasonable value of the medical services rendered, what is a court then to do? Is it to embarrass itself and say, I've admitted this evidence, but you can't consider it in regards to determining the amount of money that the fair and reasonable amount of the medical services incurred?
What if the court in this case had given instructions regarding the basic issue, the issue that you raised, but then also told the jury about issues of subrogation, issues about recovery? What if the court had reimbursement? What if the court had given all that to the jury so that the law was set by the court, but the jury just had the information about what happened? What's wrong with that? How does that interfere with the court's power?
Because the very large majority of the time on those issues, it is not a factual issue determination at all. It is a simple question of law. And so why should the jury's mind be influenced by anything that it doesn't have to decide?
Isn't the real problem in this case the fact that the court didn't tell the jury about Medicare's right of reimbursement?
No. I think the real problem in this situation is that this statute, and I think the trial judge felt, was intended to take away from him the power and the right to determine the law.
Well, let me see if I can understand your argument. The rule of law continues. Well, I'll start differently. Suppose the legislature had adopted a statute that said, in Med-Mal cases, the victim is entitled only to reimbursement for expenses caused by the medical malpractice, which the plaintiff, for which the plaintiff paid, and the plaintiff, the victim, is not entitled to reimbursement for any medical expenses which he did not pay and was paid either by of insurance, by reduction, by Medicare, anything else. Okay? Would that statute be valid?
I think that statute does not face a challenge based on the separation of powers.
Okay. And that's your point. That states the law, and the legislature has a right to state the law as long as it's reasonable and rational, and you can argue that it's reasonable and rational. They made a decision on collateral source other than the courts have done over the years. Okay. The legislature did not do that.
That's correct.
The legislature says you're entitled to reasonable medical expenses, but then says you can tell the jury that somebody else paid for them, and the jury can do whatever the devil it wants to do about that. So it can totally ignore that evidence, even though it's not disputed. It can discount it at a third, or whatever it wants to do, or it can totally discount it the way the jury in this case did, right?
Correct.
And your position is that the jury is then deciding the law.
Correct.
The judge has no way of giving instructions other than do whatever the devil you want to do.
Correct. And an appellate court has no way of reviewing
it. And that is the core function.
Correct.
I don't know if I accept it, but I think I understand that. That's your position.
Yep.
Is it rational? Not your position. On separation of powers, you also challenge this under due process and equal protection, right?
Correct.
On what basis do you do that?
The basis for the due process and equal protection, basically I think these things are kind of tied in together, but in regards to equal protection, I think this statute in practical application will treat members of the same class of people, i.e. people hurt by negligence on the part of medical care providers differently, and I'll give you a few examples of that in a second. And in regards to the due process, I think our position is, again, somewhat related in that when you assign this function of making the law or deciding what rule of law should govern damages to the jury, it obviously is not going to apply equally and across the board to that class of individuals. Rather, it's going to be arbitrarily and capriciously decided differently on a case-by-case basis.
There are no standards.
Correct.
There are no standards.
Correct. And,
Mr. Harris, doesn't the legislature here have a rational basis for drawing the distinction between medical malpractice and other tort claims, that rational basis being we're trying to hold down health care costs, and if we hold down verdicts, we hold down health care costs. What's wrong with that reason?
Well, this court has held they have a rational basis for distinguishing that class of victims, and so I'm not going to challenge that on this basis today. The issue comes down on the equal protection and the due process of the effects of this statute within that class, I think. And so I don't think your honors question in that regards is relevant to this particular case.
You're saying that all victims of medical malpractice are not going to be treated the same because there's no standard for the jury to decide when to consider the amount of reimbursement.
Don't we give juries a wide range of discretion in regard to what's an appropriate recovery, for instance, for pain and suffering? What is wrong with allowing discretion to a jury?
That is a totally separate issue in regards to the pain and suffering, because in regards to pain and suffering, the jury is at least given specific guidelines and is instructed on what the law is as to those elements it should consider or not consider. Whereas under this statute, a jury is given no instructions and no guidelines.
Okay. Mr. Harris, is the collateral source rule codified somewhere in the statutes?
No, I think is the short story of that. But I think when the court talks about collateral source, or maybe not the court, I shouldn't put that burden on you, but when attorneys talk about collateral source, they sometimes do it somewhat arbitrarily and capriciously. And there's two parts of, quotes, what I think the legislature, at least part of the time, thought of collateral source. The one part is, what items of damages is a plaintiff entitled to recover? This statute doesn't purport to deal with that issue or to change that rule of law, which has long been established in this state, as it has in most others, as the fair and reasonable value of the medical services that a person had to incur as a result of the negligence.
And the court can instruct that to the jury, is that correct?
The court can instruct that to a jury.
And should.
And should.
And did.
And did, but then it also instructed other things.
But it did say fair and reasonable value.
Yeah.
When I looked in the index to the statutes under insurance, under liability, there was a notation, collateral source rule, and it said 904.11. Evidence that a person was or was not insured against liability is not admissible upon the issue whether the person acted negligently or otherwise wrongfully. This section does not require the exclusion of evidence of insurance against liability when offered for another purpose, such as proof of agency, ownership, or control, or bias, or prejudice of a witness. Now, I look at the caption of this case. Who are the defendants?
The actual defendants in this case,
Your Honor, as they appear, were Little Work Hospital, the health system, and Red Cedar Clinic, the health system.
But the caption also lists ABC Insurance Company and DEF Insurance Company, and doesn't that information often get to the jury?
That sort of information often gets to the jury, but the jury is also specifically instructed by the court that it's as to the things it can be considered for or shouldn't be considered for.
Well, didn't the fact that the legislature authorized direct suit against insurance companies contradict the common law?
Yeah.
Okay, and the information that there are insurance companies involved, that often seeps through to the jury. Could that affect damages?
It should if the jury disregards its oath as jurors.
Well, why can't this statute be cured by instructions, too?
I don't see how it possibly can. For example, an insurance company's name may appear in a verdict. The jury is often told an insurance company's name appears here, but the liability of the defendant is the same whether or not there's insurance company or it's not. There's no issue as to insurance coverage. You're not to concern yourself with it. I have never seen a court allow evidence of limits of liability, of the fact that the individual defendant isn't going to have to pay any verdict that's reasonably expected by counsel on either side. I have never seen a court admit such testimony because it's irrelevant to issues the jury has to decide.
Sitting at counsel table, is it possible that a defendant, say healthcare provider, has an attorney and the insurance company has an attorney?
In limited cases, that occurs.
Why is the question of offset and whether or not there should be an offset in the case, why is that not a factual determination as opposed to what you assert a legal determination?
Because typically, who is entitled to what money from that recovery is defined by a contractual document between plaintiff and an insurance company. And there are typically, in the very large majority of cases that happen, there's typically no factual issue for the jury to decide on that.
I think that if there's an offset in the sense that they've been paid back by somebody else, that is a fact question. Were you reimbursed for expenses, medical expenses, by the ABC Insurance Company? And that was put in here. That is, that they were reimbursed for various expenses. So it's a fact for the jury to find whether there was or wasn't reimbursement and in what amount. I think that the issue, as I understand it, and maybe I'm misunderstanding your argument, is sure. But the question of law is, what's the jury supposed to do with that information? If the jury is supposed to offset it, and how much, the jury should be told. But what the jury is not told, if I understood your argument, is what they're supposed to do with this information. The answer that you give in your brief is they can do whatever they want. And the jury instructions say that. You can do whatever you want with this information. You're saying that's the question of law, not whether there was an offset.
Correct.
All right?
Let me follow up on that, because I hear you differently.
All right.
I hear you saying that whether or not there is entitlement to an offset is per se a question of law. And because it is a question of law, not a question of fact, it's not for the jury to decide. To compound that problem, that they are deciding a question of law rather than fact, is the circumstance that they are given no direction about what to do about it. So tell me, what is it?
I think that is a correct statement. I think there are two elements that happen here. And For example, in the situation where there is an ERISA carrier that is entitled only to reimbursement rights and or would have a right to elect either subrogation rights or reimbursement rights, but elects, as ERISA carriers are tending to do now, not to participate in exercise subrogation rights, but rather to exercise reimbursement rights against any recovery. If you try a medical malpractice case, jury is told ERISA carriers paid the $250,000 of medical, plaintiff recovers lost wages and $250,000 for pain and suffering. Plaintiff is then sued and is obligated to pay $250,000 to reimburse the ERISA carrier. And so the plaintiff has now been whipsawed by a jury deciding a legal question as a factual basis, so to speak, or at least if you adopt the theory of the statute. And then the legal question is going to be determined by a federal judge based on the law of the ERISA contract that they're entitled to be reimbursed out of any recovery that the plaintiff makes.
Well, why can't they tell the jury it's highly likely that although $250,000 was paid in meds, the plaintiff is going to have to pay that back?
Because traditionally courts have said we're not going to allow things that are irrelevant to factual determinations that the jury has to make.
I expected you to say that here you tried to bring in that evidence that you might be required to pay back Medicare, but that the judge didn't let you do that. And you had to weasel word it.
I think the core zone of the judicial function here is invaded on both bases, and I really think the statute should be declared unconstitutional for that basis. It seems to me courts should not be willing to accept a rule in evidence imposed upon them by the legislature that requires them to allow a jury to hear evidence that simply is totally unrelated to the factual question a jury is supposed to determine.
Counsel, it's related. This is like, you know, what the legislature giveth, you're here to try to take it away. In other words, the court will do something about it. But basically, as I understand the argument, either way, whether it's a windfall to the defendant or it's a windfall to the plaintiff, it's considered to be a windfall to somebody, and the argument usually from the legal side, the attorney's side, the plaintiff's side is, look, the tortfeasor should not get a windfall. If anybody gets it, it ought to go to the person that was injured. And here, what the legislature did was to basically allow this information, whether you say it's relevant or irrelevant, they've made it relevant. They have said it comes in. It's admissible, okay? At least concede it's admissible. And the argument that I think the other side is making is that I'm talking about the legislative background of this is that, well, then maybe there won't be a windfall. In other words, if you get reimbursed, then you don't get it twice. And that's what you're up here trying to say is a core function of this body, the judiciary, and the legislature should not have done that. That's, in a nutshell, that's what's happening here. If I misstated?
I still disagree with you in that the legislature, by the history of this statute, didn't purport to change the law on damages. It says so in its own legislative history.
But they did. They just wanted to make it available.
They wanted to make evidence admissible. The large majority of the time in a question of weight, that sort of thing, I would expect this court to give appropriate leeway and respect to the decision of the legislature. This isn't one of those cases. This is inherently different, I believe, from a rape shield law, for example, where the legislature, considering its policy, and public policy reasons, concludes that on the issue of credibility, there are reasons for a court to allow this testimony. There are reasons for public policy to protect the witness's privacy. And we just believe this should be the law on that issue.
Counsel, I have one quick question for you. If the legislature had heard, the jury had heard the same information that it did, and instead of making offsets, it had awarded in the verdict damages to your client for medical services for which someone else had paid. So I heard it all, but it didn't deduct anything, and you got all the dollars that were either paid or written off, so nobody paid them. Would you be obligated to turn those monies over to the payor of the service, or does your client get to keep that money?
In this particular case where the payments were made by Medicare, we are obligated to pay that directly to Medicare.
Okay, and if it were not Medicare but a straight insurance company, would you be able to keep that money or would you have to pay it back?
In the very large majority of circumstances, we would be obligated to pay that back.
It would depend on the contract with the insurance
company. Depending upon the contract with the insurance company, but in today's world, with ERISA plans, the very large majority of the time, you are obligated to pay.
But that's ERISA, because ERISA law controls, which is going to be federal law rather than state law, so they don't really care about a lot of other doctrines we may have here. I understand that. Okay, thank you.
So the result of this case is you got $755, and you might have the obligation to reimburse Medicare anyway if you had enough sufficient funds in the estate?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Harris, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney DeBow, representing the hospital.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. I would like to do something a little odd, and that is to start with something that is not at all controversial. There is an instruction that I think every trial court sitting in the state knows well. It's instruction 190. It's the closing instruction before you send the jury away. And it speaks to things such as you're going to go in and elect a foreperson. You're going to arrive at a verdict. And there's a line in that instruction that I've actually had jurors come to me after cases and tell me is a very important line. And that is this. It is, let your verdict speak the truth, whatever the truth may be. Truth of the matter in this case is that the plaintiffs here paid out $755 out of pocket for medical expenses. The truth of the matter is the jury awarded them $755 for the medical expenses they paid out. I would suggest that that verdict did exactly what the jury was instructed to do by announcing the truth. And the only way that the jury was able to recognize that as the truth is through the existence of 89355 sub 7. The fact that we're here today...
Then is the law changed? It's not reasonable value of the services. It's what you paid, a reasonable payment for the services out of your own pocket. Is that the rule of law?
I think I believe there's two answers to that, Your Honor. First is what is contained in Section 655.009.
That's why I'm asking you that.
Yes, I think that the legislature has spoken to the issue that it is payments that is what matters in medical malpractice.
If that's true, then why do you need subsection 7 in 89355? If the rule of law is only what you paid out, then it's relevant to that rule of law that you've been reimbursed. So you wouldn't need any extra law on that.
Well, I think that the evidence would still need to come in. In a typical case where it is pled out appropriately consistent with 80303, then what you're going to have is the plaintiff as a party. You're also going to have the subrogated interests as a party. And there's no reason that they are not all entitled to a line on the verdict asking what should be fair and reasonable compensation to that particular party.
But in asking what's fair and reasonable compensation to that party, you still have issues of subrogation and issues of reimbursement that are out there. And in this case, as I understood the facts, the jury wasn't told about that, even though there was an attempt to tell the jury about that. So if the goal is to give the jury the truth, don't you have to give them the whole truth?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that the entire problem there arises out of the fact that Medicare was never named as a party to this action. And if you go through, and it's certainly alluded to in some of our briefs, the trial court struggled mightily with that issue and the implication of that issue. And it was the trial court concluded, I believe correctly, that because Medicare was not a party, you know, it could not affect their rights or relieve Medicare of the obligation of essentially proving its claim up.
But whether Medicare was a party or not doesn't deal with the fact that Medicare may have a right of reimbursement against the plaintiffs here, right? Well, that fact remains. The jury wasn't told about that. So if the jury is not told about that, you've now got a situation where the plaintiff's in a position where the plaintiff has gotten $755 recovery and may owe, what was it, 80-something thousand? What was the amount?
Well, I think that's overstated. That amount was in dispute, and there never was any proof on it actually elicited.
But my point is that there may be a debt that's out there. If the jury does not know that, if the jury is not instructed as to the implications of its verdict, then how is the jury reaching its fair and just result based on all of the evidence?
And I think the problem there, Your Honor, also arises out of the fact that the jury was not instructed that Medicare could still sue my client directly.
But you would agree that the jury should have been instructed then?
I had requested that if that part of the instruction be given, that the jury could also be told that my client was still susceptible to a cause of action directly against Medicare. And the trial court ruled that neither of those pieces of information would come in. And I believe that to be correct. What was on the verdict was what the plaintiffs, through their tactical decisions and how they put out the case and how they did it, was what is the estate's claim for medical expenses. Now, we're dealing with some awkwardness, but that awkwardness arises out of the tactical decisions that were made on how to plead the case out. I don't think it in any way implicates 89355 sub 7. This case came before the jury saying, what is fair and reasonable to give the estate of Vance Lagerstrom?
Well, so if you look at sub 7 says this section does not limit the substantive or procedural rights of persons who have claims based upon subrogation. For at least any of the subrogated parties, it would be at least appear, based on that statute, that the jury should be instructed about issues regarding subrogation and the fact that there are subrogation issues that are outstanding. That seems to be clear in the statute.
And I think that the case, if it's played out correctly, then that is right. In this case, I don't think that necessarily has to occur. The reason being that if the court had instructed on that, and for instance, we get into the situation that Mr. Harris is being questioned on earlier, what if they know that and they still don't award the money, then you have a situation where the statute may have operated in a way not intended. But here, I think the trial court very clearly and carefully decided what was going to be put before the jury and allowed what was put out to be put there.
But if I could, and I'll make this the last question along this line, if I could just stress once again, this subsection does not limit the substantive or procedural rights of persons who have claims based upon subrogation. Doesn't that mean that the court has then a duty under this statute to instruct a jury about issues regarding subrogation and the impact it can have and would have upon this case?
Yes, when the subrogated party is named.
But only when the subrogated party is named. That's your position.
That's right. And I think if you think about the situation that's caused here, by the fact that they were not named as a party, the court would be affecting their rights by trying to instruct the jury without their input. This court had no jurisdiction at that point in time over Medicare because Medicare was never made a party. If it did something that could be conceived as affecting their rights, the court would have been violating the statute at that point. And it's a matter of Medicare certainly has the substantive right to make a claim. It had the procedural right to make a claim independently against my clients. And though it's not in the record, we have had discussions with Medicare subsequent to the verdict on this case. They have not just gone away peacefully into the night.
Mr. DeBoer, let me tell you what's bothering me. This is a wrongful death case, right?
Yes.
the maximum recovery for pre-death damages non-economic?
Excuse me?
The maximum recovery for pre-death non-economic damages and the maximum recovery for loss of society and companionship are capped at what point at this time of the case? Is it $350,000? Okay.
Under Moore, yes.
$350,000 under Moore. And because you have a very elderly gentleman, those damages are rather small considering his lifetime expectancy. All right. But you could have had a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old leaving several children. So you cap those damages at $350,000. Now we're into economic damages in this. And as a result here, and it wouldn't matter if it was $85,000 or $250,000 or $500,000, he gets $755. So the recovery is $755. I'm assuming that in a case, maybe not this one, but in most cases, you need to do discovery, expert witnesses, and that medical malpractice cases are very expensive for plaintiff as a general rule. I'm sure there are exceptions. You agree with that?
I think that is the conventional wisdom, Your Honor.
So, when you limit damages this way, both economic damages, medical expenses, and non-economic damages, aren't you in effect, although it never shows on the face of the statute, seeing that it'll be extremely difficult to get lawyers because most of these cases would have to be done on a contingent fee. And since the recovery is relatively small compared to potential expenses, if you're going to do a good job, and if you're not going to do a good job, you're going to be sued for malpractice. You don't take it unless you can do a good job on it. That you are in effect denying, the legislature is denying to people access to lawyers.
Well, I don't know that I would reach that conclusion.
Well, I don't expect you to do it, but that's what's bothering me.
I understand, certainly, and I think Your Honor raised some of these issues in her concurrence in Moore.
And this just adds to it, because if you added $85,000 or $250,000, now we're getting into a verdict that a lawyer might very well be encouraged to take the case. But when you keep dropping the damages that can be recovered, you keep dropping access to counsel. That's my point.
And I suppose that my best answer to that, Your Honor, is that with all due respect to your point and your feelings on that, the legislature also has a say in this issue. And it does get back to the nature of, you know, this legislature has decided that caps are appropriate. This legislature has decided that a number of things which limit the potential recovery to medical malpractice is appropriate. And so we believe that it is serving a public good. And these are
no damages at all for medical mal. We're just not allowing that tort anymore in Wisconsin.
I don't even think that that could get through the legislature, and there would certainly be subject to questions about availability of remedy, although we certainly get into things like Acre, where remedy was cut off for certain players. And that may very well be the case, but it is the legislature that has been vested with both the right and the responsibility to make those social and economic and political decisions on behalf of the citizens of the state.
Zero may raise constitutional or other questions, but $750,755 does not.
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
I said zero damages would raise constitutional questions, but $350,755 does not. raise constitutional questions of
remedy. I think the zero raises the right to remedy provision in the Constitution, which has not been invoked here. Has not been played out or argued at any level.
Mr. DeBoe, I'm troubled by your answer to the Chief's question a moment ago. Are you saying that 89355 sub 7 is designed to limit recovery?
I think it is designed to make sure that the amounts that medical malpractice defendants have to pay out is precisely in line with the expenses that are incurred by the individuals making
the
payments.
You think that's the purpose of the statute? Because if that's the purpose of the statute, doesn't that support Mr. Harris's argument that, well, wait a minute, now you're going into an area that's judicial? I mean, it's one thing to say this evidence is admissible, the jury can consider it. That doesn't indicate what the jury should do with it, which is a separate issue that I've tried to get at with some of my questions about how should the court be instructing with respect to the law. But if you're saying that this changes the substantive law, then we have a different issue here, don't we?
I don't think so. I think what the court is struggling with, and it's one of the things that I believe the Court of Appeals was also struggling with in its certification that runs implicit through a lot of this, is the question of whether or not the collateral source rule is a substantive law or a procedural law. And I think that the answer to that is to a certain extent that it's both. This court has recognized the effect that collateral source evidence can have on a jury's deliberations. It is, I believe, clear from the legislative history and from the studies that were cited by the legislature that the legislature determined that having a statute such as this will serve to reduce medical malpractice awards and help keep access to health care more affordable in the state. That was part of their reliance on the California study. It does show up in the record before this court. So,
Mr. DeBell, your answer to Justice Butler surprised me, because your brief says, and you said it all, argument 655.009 sub 2, if I understand your argument, is that the amount of damages in medical malpractice is what the plaintiffs reasonably paid out of their own pocket.
That's correct. It focuses on payments, Your Honor.
That's right. That's different than the general rule in non-medical malpractice cases.
That's correct.
Personal injury with an auto. Therefore, you can easily say, in response to Justice Butler, that 89355.7 is relevant, because if the rule, the substantive rule, is payment, 89355.7 says you can prove payment or non-payment.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
And it's not, it's a substantive rule, unlike your opposing counsel who says no, 893.557 didn't change the substance of how much you're entitled to be awarded. You say it did under 655.0092, and that the rule, well, because it's amount paid, not reasonable value of services. That's how you interpret 655.009, don't you?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah. So the change in substantive law is there.
That would be where the change in substance is, in that 89355 simply allows the evidence that makes that
right.
Possible.
An evidentiary rule. If so, then why does that rule say may consider instead of shall consider?
Why does 89355 say it may consider?
Right. Shall consider because it's totally relevant to the change in the law.
I think the discretion would probably come in when we look at the joinder rules under 80303. Once a subrogated party is joined, they essentially have three options that they can follow. One is to represent their own interest. The second is to allow the plaintiff or the person who caused the joinder to represent the interest. Or three is to bow out of the case. I think that depending on which of those options a subrogated carrier might choose may determine in how the court is going to apply 89355.
Okay, here there was no joinder. So what should the jury instruction have said? May or shall?
May. And that is what the court instructed
Well, when should the jury instruction say shall? Anytime?
I don't believe that that would be a problem if the jury instruction said shall. That would be essentially the same as telling the jury that they shall consider all evidence that is put before them and to give it the weight that they believe it is entitled. And I think that that is also referenced in other more general instructions.
Should the jury have been instructed that the amount of damages for medical expenses is the amount paid, reasonably paid, rather than the amount than the reasonable value of the services? Maybe that was the wrong jury instruction here.
I think that may be so. And I've actually toyed with the idea of what an appropriate instruction under 893.55.7 would be.
No, it's not under 893.55. It's under 655.009. That's what we're talking about.
That's right.
That's where the jury instruction may have gone askew, right? I mean, if your argument is right.
That would be correct, Your Honor.
Tell the jury that it's only paid by plaintiff.
That's right. And there's a pattern instruction, I believe it's 1754, that would be very easy to modify in medical malpractice cases to incorporate the dictates of 655.092.
But it wasn't modified here.
That was not done. That was not raised. But at this point, it would be, I think, harmless error.
Mr. DeBoer, I'd like to go to something you said quite a bit earlier in your argument. And that was that there had been a number of contacts by Medicare with your client. Now, as I understood Mr. Harris, he was telling us that his fear was that he, on behalf of his clients, would have to provide reimbursement to Medicare based on the recovery. Has been Medicare looking to both of you?
I am not privy to the conversations that Medicare has had with Mr. Harris, so I don't know exactly what the nature of that conversation is.
Have they been looking to your clients, though?
Yes. Subsequent to this verdict, I have been contacted by General Counsel for Medicare looking for money. Yes.
On the basis of the fact that the jury found fault on behalf of your clients here?
That's correct. To be more precise, Your Honor, we did concede negligence, and we argued
over causation. They found causation liability.
They found causation and liability, although this case was complicated by the fact that Mr. Lagerstrom was a very ill gentleman, and an issue that we prepared to put before the jury was what care subsequent to this event was related and caused by it and what was not. That evidence never came in directly through plaintiffs. There was, therefore, nothing for us to rebut. And it created the situation in which Medicare had, I understand subsequently now, had asked for essentially all the money they had paid subsequent to the incident back. That was not, we got to the point where we agreed that not everything subsequent to the incident was related, but there never was any proof on what was and was not related. So the way to determine what portion of Medicare's payments were and were not causally related.
Could I ask you, Mr. DeBoer, whether 893.55.7 is a unique provision in the United States?
Not at all, Your Honor. Not at all. As a matter of fact, well over half the states have enacted similar statutes. Each is a little different. Some states have enacted statutes making collateral source evidence admissible across the board. But I believe at this point the majority of states do have on their books statutes similar to 893.55 that are applicable to medical malpractice cases.
Any challenge for constitutionality or otherwise?
Yes, they have been challenged for constitutionality in just about every state. And I recognize that it is not cited, I believe, in either of the submissions to this court, but there's an ALR annotation that summarizes a number of those challenges. The uniform holding in those cases is that the constitutional challenges have only been effective when they were analyzed under a strict scrutiny standard. And that was in just a couple of jurisdictions where they believe strict scrutiny was the appropriate standard of review. Here, I think it's clear because of the provisions of our Constitution vis-a-vis, I think it's the Kentucky Constitution where such a law was struck down, that we are here under a rational basis standard. That would be the distinction. And the ALR makes clear that, when challenged under the rational basis standard, these statutes pass constitutional muster quite regularly.
What about separation of powers?
And also under separation of powers. The only case that I have encountered in which separation of powers was successfully argued was that Kentucky case. I believe it's cited in the brief of one of the amicis. And that dealt with a very specific provision within the Kentucky Constitution regarding the court's function that is simply not at issue under the Wisconsin Constitution. I think one of the things that has permeated much of the comments and much of the argument that has that the appellants have made here is this notion that the jury is being required to do something other than what it would normally do. And the issue has been raised, if I could restate the Chief Justice's summarization earlier, is that there is no guidance being given on the central question of what the jury should do with this evidence. And I think the problem here arises out of we may have lost focus of exactly what the jury is being asked. I would think that could be a problem if the jury was asked, what should the defendant pay? But that's not the question that the jury is being asked. The jury is asked, what is fair and reasonable for this particular plaintiff to receive? And that is, I think, the inherent tension that this
court... That isn't what the jury was asked. The jury was asked, what is the reasonable value of the medical services?
I believe what the jury was asked is, what is fair and reasonable compensation to this plaintiff for the medical services? And this, the problem is that they're not asked what the reasonable value of the services is. They're asked what is fair and reasonable to award this particular plaintiff, much as they're asked what is fair and reasonable amount for pain and suffering, what is a fair and reasonable amount for.
Why is that the correct question? If there is negligence and if there is causation and if there is a sum certain, undisputed amount, you know, I grant you some cases maybe the amount could be disputed, but if it's a sum certain, then why as a matter of law isn't the plaintiff entitled? I mean, that may not be this case, but in another case, if there is negligence and if there is causation, I can't imagine what's left of the lawsuit, so why would it be dried? But if there's a sum certain that was paid, the medical bills are undisputed.
I can tell you, Your Honor, in practice that comes up all the time. And at that point where it is truly undisputed, counsel generally agree as to what that sum certain is.
And then the kind of question that, of course, is inserted in the verdict, yeah.
Exactly. And I would venture that probably half the cases I've ever taken to jury have exactly that, because there is no dispute with respect to that. And that sort of situation, again, in a case under 893.55, where you have all the appropriate people on the verdict, wouldn't be a problem. As a matter of fact, that's precisely the sort of relief I would anticipate subrogated carriers requesting as well as plaintiffs requesting, that if there really is no dispute that the plaintiff paid $1,000 out of pocket and the subrogated carrier paid $25,000 out of pocket, they would request lines on the verdict showing that. And if I have no defense to that, sitting as a defendant, then I have no defense to that, and it would be frivolous for me to argue otherwise.
Counsel, I want to turn your attention to the funeral expenses. And there
yes.
were about $7,500 that were uncontested. That was the amount that was spent. Yet the jury awarded nothing after having negligence admitted and finding the man's death was caused at least in part by the negligence. Isn't that finding then of zero damages for funeral expenses inconsistent with those other two findings of the jury, and shouldn't the judge have changed the question as opposing counsel requested?
I don't think so. I think 895.04 does use the permissive may with respect to the award of funeral expenses. I guess the flip side of that, Your Honor, would be the case, I think the argument that's being made is that any time you find that a specific event was a cause of death, then funeral expenses must be awarded.
Well, if the funeral expenses were contested, I can see how the may works out, or if someone spent $30,000 on a funeral and that was uncontested, I can see where the may works out, but to award a man zero to be buried, I have difficulty fitting that really within the parameters of what was meant by may.
Well, and I think that's where the judge summed it up very nicely at his rulings on the motions after verdict, is I'm going to apply my common sense. And the unfortunate truth was that we were dealing with the gentleman, Mr. Lagerstrom, who was very, very ill, and there was a question of whether or not he was going to make it out of the hospital after his initial surgery before the unfortunate event which brings us all together occurred. I think the jury used his common sense that this was a family who was and should have been prepared to be paying funeral expenses very soon. I would certainly have no argument if the jury had awarded the entire amount, but they chose not to.
Counsel, at some point, everyone in this courtroom is going to have to face that day. We'll all have to bear funeral expenses. To follow up on Justice Rogenczak's question, you still have an issue of negligence and causation here, and whether he was going to die that year or 20 years down the road really is irrelevant, isn't it?
Well, I think it was, Your Honor, because the question, if you want to think about it in these terms, oftentimes in medical malpractice cases, you're dealing with very ill patients to start with. The way that juries will approach these is not what are their medical expenses, but what additional expenses have they or will they incur because of the act complained of. Here, I suspect that the jury did exactly the same sort of analysis and asked itself the question, what additional funeral expenses was this family getting ready to incur? And they found, and I believe quite rightly, and it's supported by the evidence, that the answer to that was zero. So
a short answer to you, to the question is, as I understand you, is that negligence and causation do not necessarily equal damages, even though you may have damage.
I believe that is correct, Your Honor. And I think that if the legislature had wanted a different result, the legislature would have used the word shall in that statute. But the legislature chose not to. And that was something I believe that's within their purview. I think to handle cases much as this one.
Counsel, was there another instruction given? I'm looking at 1850. And it is entitled The State Recovery for Medical, Hospital, and Funeral Expenses. And the only reference to funeral expenses is the last paragraph in the instruction. It says, Subdivision C of Question 4 asks what sum of money will fairly and reasonably compensate the estate of Vance Lagerstrom for the funeral and burial expenses of Mr. Lagerstrom. Was there any other direction on
Other than the general damage instructions and the burden of proof instructions and those, no. That's the only one I believe that used the term funeral expenses, but obviously the jury receives a number of damage instructions that are more general as to how they should assess evidence and what they should do with it. I do see my red light is on, so I will thank Your Honors for your attention and your questions, and allow Mr. Harris to speak.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Harris, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I do have two or three issues I'd like to respond to. In regards to the defense's argument that 655.009 should stand for the proposition that only parties who have paid medical expenses are entitled to recover them. If you adopt that rationale, then someone who has incurred $250,000 of medical expense and has no health insurance isn't able to make a claim for those expenses because they have not paid the bill. And
that's not what the statute says, though, is it? The statute says the court or jury, whichever is applicable, shall determine the amounts of medical expense payments previously incurred and for future medical expense payments. Isn't that just another way of describing reasonable value of services?
I believe every court that's ever dealt with that issue has interpreted it that way. But I think the defense argument of what the statute says is significantly different than that. In regards to, I believe it was one of the justices over here on the right, I don't remember which one, had asked defense counsel about instructions and subrogation, and the point was brought up that the statute is not intended to affect rights of subrogation. In the history section that's in the appendix regarding the legislative history of the statute, the legislature history noted some health insurers expressed concern that this might affect their ability to exercise their subrogation rights, whereby they pay for an injury, then seek to recover from the plaintiff if the plaintiff receives compensation again through the malpractice award. What they're talking about there is what I think most attorneys would talk about as reimbursement rates, at least in that example of subrogation, rather than traditional subrogation where a party might have a right to bring the action in their own name. What happened in this case would specifically work to at least potentially affect those reimbursement rates, as I pointed out before, and thus I think the legislative history of the statute itself reflects that it was perhaps ill thought out in the practical workings of the statute. In regards,
what if the court had instructed the jury that you should be apprised define subrogation, define reimbursement, you should be apprised that those issues exist in this case and that the plaintiff may be subject to those issues. What if the court had done that?
I still think that the court's core zone of authority is invaded because it deprives the court of all authority to deal with those legal issues and to protect the party's legal rights under those issues.
If the court does that, if the court defines the law for the jury and tells them how to apply it, the only thing that I see that's interfered with here is a ruling on admissibility.
I wouldn't quite agree with that totally, but I do think the ruling on admissibility is more important from my point of view to the court's core zone.
I want the jury to know about it.
But let's consider this fact. Let's say the jury decides we're going to discount the medical damages by 25% because it's only a maybe that the party that has reimbursement rates will seek them. Traditionally, in the part of the woods I practice in, a court would say in that type of situation, Harris, before we give you judgment, you're going to bring in here something from the ERISA plan that says they're going to be bound by it or they're going to accept this amount of money, or Harris, I'll give you judgment, but I'm keeping the medical expense because there's a until the issues get resolved between you and the ERISA carrier. How much money in that case is the judge supposed to hold on to? The entire amount that the subrogation carrier or the reimbursement carrier is claiming? Or just the amount awarded by the jury? I think this statute wreaks all sorts of havoc on court's inherent power to see that parties get fair trials, but to see that justice is done among a number of people. And so in the earlier cases, the Barlin case, the court ruled that it was within the core zone of judicial function to determine whether or not a judicial assistant is terminated and that a county board, by entering into a collective bargaining agreement, can't invade that zone. From my perspective, I think the citizens of the state of Wisconsin deserve the court to have the court say that the right to have juries hear only relevant information, the rights to have courts determine questions of law are as important as whether or not the judicial assistant can be terminated, and we'd ask the court to hold this statute unconstitutional. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Harris, and thank you, Mr. DeVoe, for the court's first look at subsection 7. That concludes our hearing in 03. 20-2027, Lancaster v. Myrtle Worth Hospital. The court is adjourned for its December case sitting. The court will reconvene at 1:30 in the conference room. We are adjourned. The students should remain here, and Justice Crooks will be out shortly. Yeah.